A recent Rasmussen survey found that just 11% of likely U.S. voters think Congress is doing a good or excellent job. Whether it's frustration with the coming election or the state of the union in general, there's no question that Americans are concerned by growing wealth inequality, political corruption, and congressional inaction, and presidential candidates from both parties are tapping into voters' gut feelings. In No Billionaire Left Behind, anthropologist Angelique Haugerud reveals how frustration inspires satire and irony as a form of political protest. She's a former editor of American Ethnologist and an associate professor of anthropology at Rutgers University. This conversation about frustration kicks off our show's Primary Emotions political series, and I'm very pleased it has brought Professor Haugerud to our show today. And, of course, we are inviting our listeners to call in. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Now, what is satirical activism? Is this something that we've always had? Wasn't Mark Twain satirical about politics?
Absolutely. And thank you very much, by the way, for having me as a guest. This is a lineage that goes back a long time. Satirical activism is something I've had a lot of fun studying quite intensively for the last decade. And the activists I studied called themselves billionaires for different things at different times, billionaires for Bush or Gore, billionaires for Bush, billionaires for more media mergers, billionaires for tar sands, lobbyists for McCain, multimillionaires for Mitt. They are concocting some new names right now. Possibly we might see trillionaires for Trump. There's already a website up called Billionaires Against Bernie.
All pretty much the same people?
And they are shifting networks. There's a core of them that have remained with the organization for a long time. But in terms of what it is, they define themselves in opposition to what they are labeling as traditional protesters, feeding off of popular images and stereotypes of scruffy protesters who are often demeaned by a sector of the public. And they cast themselves as very savvy, brand-conscious, witty. They dress up, tuxedos, top hats, ball gowns, tiaras, very polished visuals, professional signs. And they adopt satirical names. They have fictive personas. They create whole stories around them with names such as Phil T. Rich, Ivan Aston Martin, Lucinda Regulations, as in loosen the regulations, Robin U. Blind, Mega Bucks. One calls himself, this is how he presents himself, my name is Noah, no accountability. Mm-hmm. And they also have Text Shelter and others. And then they spend a lot of time crafting slogans that will distill a message very, very clearly, such as corporations are people too, taxes are not for everyone, it's a class war and we're winning.
And are any of these people wealthy? Where do they come from?
No.
What do they do when they're not protesting?
A very tiny fraction might be trust fund kids, but many of them are actors, writers, artists, a few academics, some corporate PR people, a wide range of professions, many of them struggling, actually, financially.
Did they change their focus when Occupy Wall Street movement began?
So we can see them, in a sense, as almost precursors to Occupy. They obviously have very similar issues. And at Occupy, some of them showed up as billionaires for plutocracy and billionaires for various other entities. And some of them stepped out of costume and participated in Occupy in the traditional scruffy protester attire in varying capacities.
And now their current site is billionairesagainstbernie.com?
Yes. And this is a plot that was just hatched a few weeks ago. I was at some planning meetings on the Lower East Side with part of their brain trust recently. And they launched the website. There's all kinds of information there about how people can set up a chapter, choose a name, produce signs. There's suggested slogans. The whole idea is that this is a do-it-yourself approach. They had a terrific polished website for the various billionaires during the 2000s and up to the last election. And now they're just beginning to strategize about this particular election.
How would you describe their audience? Who are they going after?
So satirists are always kind of straddling a divide across multiple audiences. It's very tricky, very delicate, and very subtle. Ideally, they imagine that they can persuade some voters to at least consider issues in a new way, to reconsider their positions, and perhaps cross over from Republican to Democratic. And at the same time, their audience, because of their slogan, because their slogans and their irony depends on some prior knowledge of public events and so on, we know that their audience is probably largely middle class, upper middle class, and fairly well educated to some extent.
And you said that they often get a better reception from the public and the media than serious protesters.
Absolutely. It's quite fun to watch.
Does that help their cause?
Well, that's also a really complicated question, but it's fun to watch them play off serious protesters. You may have Sierra Club protesters, someone dressed as a two-headed fish, and other kinds of wonderful costumes in the same protest scene as the billionaires. And the media tend to flock to the billionaires because they're well-dressed, they're witty, they are deeply briefed on policy issues so that they can have repartee with reporters either in irony mode or out of irony mode. And the idea is that they can draw attention to the traditional protesters by being the media magnet and help, you know.
And they're also less likely to get punched in the face.
That is very much the case. In fact, there have been some wonderful ethnographic descriptions of how well-dressed billionaires in very, very tense protest situations with thousands and thousands of people in the streets and a lot of police have managed to sort of cruise through and diffuse a tense situation just with a tip of the hat, a joke, and a clever remark even to a policeman.
And as you mentioned earlier, the billionaires, and I'm quoting you here, evoke the elegance of the Great Gatsby's Roaring Twenties or an even earlier era of robber barons and heiresses. And audiences get that point?
Yeah, that's, again, is a very deliberate strategy because notice they're not impersonating contemporary billionaires. It's not about being Bill Gates or Oprah Winfrey or any recognizable contemporary figures, but rather playing off of very familiar popular stereotypes. Audiences absolutely get the robber baron evocativeness of their costumes and slogans. And so they're, one of them says they're impersonating an imaginary subjectivity, but it really works. The visuals really work in that respect.
How effective is humor? You've described the billionaires as a group in the spirit of the Colbert Report and the Daily Show. And a lot of people appreciate satire in a democracy. On the other hand, I'm not sure that it sways many voters. Isn't a large amount of this just simply preaching to the choir?
Yeah, that's a great question. And believe me, academics have spilled a lot of ink on that set of debates going back a long time. And the aspiration is that they can help to reframe issues, help to sort of dislodge some conventional narratives in the media and get people to think a little bit differently about their core issues. If they inspire people to become activists for the first time, if the people who participate in the billionaires are many of them are also doing serious forms of activism. They're very complementary. They feed off of each other. They're complementary as tactics. They're complementary in terms of social networks and energy and morale boosting. So there's a sense in which part of it is preaching to the choir, but they also go on the road. They had limousine tours going to the swing states in an earlier election, and they've very much went out after voters who were undecided or even in the other party and had some very meaningful street interactions and one-on-one conversations with them. And so the aim is to reach more people from the other side. The effects of humor, we have to all recognize, are very subtle, very difficult to trace. Does The Daily Show just make liberals feel a little better? Is it a therapeutic filter, as some have described it, or does it actually affect change? Well, there are at least a couple of instances where Jon Stewart did intervene very seriously in the public arena with the 9/11 first responder legislation that he sort of shamed Congress into passing a few years ago, one example. Yes, it's a mixed set of results that are quite complicated and quite difficult to trace and quite subtle.
I'm speaking with Professor Angelique Haugerud of Rutgers University. Her book, No Billionaire Left Behind, Satirical Activism in America. And we are inviting your calls on frustration in politics and what can be done to get past that at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org on Facebook or Twitter. My handle is at Leonard Lopate. And Lewis from Asbury Park, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air. Hello, Lewis. Lewis, we're on delay, so you're going to have to go to your phone right away. Okay. Well, Lewis, I'm going to put you on hold. Maybe we'll get back to you later. That is a problem. So let's talk about the protests in another on another level. Donald Trump canceled his rally in Chicago last Friday over security concerns due to the number of protesters in the street. What does that reveal about the power of protest?
We're in a sort of a wild political moment, really energized, passionate, kind of almost disorderly presidential campaign at the moment. And I think that, you know, just to sort of go to the theme of your show and of the series, the emotion of the week is frustration, which certainly drives his supporters as well as those of others. Perhaps as a starting point, we can just accept that frustration is a normal part of the human condition. And one can say there are adaptive ways to deal with it and other kinds of ways to deal with it. Frustration can lead to fear. We know fear can lead to anger. Anger can lead to hate and suffering and so on.
Haven't protesters interrupted Trump rallies before? Why do you think this incident, the last few have been getting more attention? Is it because they have erupted into violence?
It appears from the coverage that there's been an escalation of his rhetoric and what many are just depicting as incitements to violence in his rhetoric. And also, it depends on the location of the rallies. And so some of them, there's been an escalation of violence at the rallies themselves as he's moved into some industrialized states, some areas that were very active sites of Black Lives Matter protests. And as his rhetoric has escalated, it's been really interesting to see protest mobilized by those who are opposed to his message, quite multi-ethnic coalitions, you know, the students who protested at the Chicago rally, for example, who organized just a week in advance. And so it's quite an interesting phenomenon to see suddenly people in his own party criticizing him, people being mobilized to protest on the streets, and where this will lead, you know, who knows.
On the other hand, it's led some people to close ranks in support of Donald Trump. And there have been a lot of people who've been critical of Black Lives Matter. I'm wondering if it's because they are effective or because some people just totally object to their message.
Yeah. Again, almost there's sort of a conventional frame of protest, a few conventional frames in the media, and many of them are fairly negative stereotypes of any kind of protest. And so there's always a hurdle to overcome in that respect, because a protest that doesn't effectively communicate its message to the media, it's sort of a failure in the eyes of many participants. So there are already cultural slots to denigrate any movement, whether it's Black Lives Matter or Occupy or this current wave of protest, which now gets slotted in the sort of Trump Party rhetoric as unpatriotic, as anti-American, as bad people, as thugs. And that's drawing on a deep reservoir.
He said commie Bernie's people.
Right. So he's drawing on, you know, a deep reservoir of familiar cultural tropes and rhetorics and really pushing them very, very forcefully now and encouraging his supporters to do the same.
My guest is Angelique Haugerud, Haugerud. She is an associate professor of anthropology at Rutgers University. And her latest book is called No Billionaire Left Behind, Satirical Activism in America. It's published by Stanford University Press. We'll continue our conversation after we take a break, and we'll be taking your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. We're back with Angelique Haugerud. Her book, No Billionaire Left Behind, Satirical Activism in America, published by Stanford University Press. And we couldn't get Lewis from Asbury Park on earlier, but I understand he's ready now. Hi, Lewis. What did you want to tell us?
Hey, Leonard and your guest. Sorry about that earlier. You know, we started something in the we were grassroots activists, and we started something called Bus for Change way back in 2004. And we got on the road. It looked like a Partridge Family bus. It was a lot of fun. We went to a lot of events, actually worked with politicians. But you know what was the most effective? We would go to Republican rallies. At the time, it was George Bush. And we came up with the idea. We would stand there with the registration forms for the different branches of the military. And we were trying to convey the message, if you believe in this war that's going on right now, why don't you sign up for children? So we found it was more effective to get right in their faces and with a message of taking responsibility. But they would get angry at first, but it was interesting how much dialogue we were able to engage people. And, you know, there were a couple times by the end of the dialogue, you know, a little bit of time, we would get along and have some humor with each other. Because trust me, in the grassroots ranks, I found a lot of lack of humor. And it's hard to break through that sometimes. And I find it to be more effective, and it was fun, too.
Thank you for calling us. You want to respond to that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting example. Thanks for sharing that. It's interesting to see on the streets with billionaires and other groups and perhaps your own experience how you can adopt an ironic, humorous pose and be conciliatory more than aggressive. And people in the public, even people who may not agree with your message, of course, are going to be more receptive to that. It's interesting. You've just given us a hint of the kinds of topics you were focusing on. And I might just mention that the satirical billionaires who received a lot of media coverage, both international and national, were extraordinarily careful in defining the boundaries of the issues they would tackle. Main ones were wealth inequality and the role of big money in politics. But they wouldn't touch issues, culturally sensitive issues of religion, reproductive rights, and so on, because there was such a risk that that kind of humor could backfire.
Tegan from Pearl River, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I want to say I don't think that this could be a better time for you to have the billionaires and the kind of satirical activism that they stand for be on the radio. And I want to say thank you for all the wonderful things that the billionaires have done back in 2003, 2004. I definitely was crossing paths with you very often. I was part of the Rude Mechanical Orchestra and got to protest in the streets a lot with you. And I can say that, you know, firsthand experience, it definitely brought a level of safety because of the humor that they brought to the streets. And I wanted to say from my own experience, my group decided to do kind of satirical criticism of the Carlyle Group, which is one of the war profiteers that stood in line to benefit from the Iraq War. And so we dressed up as business executives and walked back and forth from one corner to the other, just acting like regular business people. But whenever we stopped at a crosswalk, we would kind of chuckle to each other and be like, oh, this is just so wonderful. All the money we're about to make, you know, with this war coming up in Iraq. And we would talk about the different types of contracts that we had coming up. And people around us would look at us and, you know, look us up and down. And the only thing that, you know, made us stand out is that we had these briefcases with the words Carlyle Group in big white letters on it. And we would just walk back and forth for a few hours, you know, once a week, and just do this action. And what it did was it made people want to be informed. I mean, people do not want to be duped. They don't want to be left in the dark. And satirical activism really makes people take notice much more than going, you know, standing out front with signs and saying, we're against this, we're against this. Well, the Carlyle Group doesn't care if they're doing that because they know that there's people who don't agree with them. But the regular people on the street might not have any idea about what's going on, and what you're doing is then instilling in them the motivation to want to go and educate themselves. And that's I think, more important.
Thank you so much for your call. Now, getting back to the theme of this conversation, which is frustration, Florida Governor Rick Scott wrote an op-ed in January under the heading Donald Trump Has America's Pulse. And he praised Trump for tapping into voters' frustrations, and he wrote, I'm glad Republicans are frustrated. I'm glad we're demanding a major change, because until we get serious about that, we will continue to get more of the same. This is a bipartisan emotion.
Yes, indeed it is. A lot of people are fed up. The poll numbers, of course, show huge percentages of voters across the political spectrum are very, very dissatisfied for very different reasons and with different diagnoses of the problems. But one thing that's happened that perhaps raises the temperature of this campaign is that the issue of wealth inequality has become so salient in this particular election cycle. We've had, you know, the Pope, President Obama, even the host at Davos, declaring wealth inequality to be one of the most serious issues of the day, something that poses pressing global risks. And yet in America, wealth differences of class have been very sensitive, almost a taboo topic often. But right now, and there's also evidence suggesting that a lot of Americans underestimate wealth inequality. There are studies by Dan Ariely and Mike Norton and others that demonstrate that people in this country vastly underestimate the actual degree of wealth inequality. But what seems to be striking people
we
now...
We have a clip of Bernie Sanders addressing the income gap last month in Minneapolis. Should we listen to it?
Sure.
Okay.
Now, people have said, Bernie, your ideas are too radical, too expensive. Well, let me put it within this context. In the last 30 years, there has been a massive redistribution of wealth in America. Problem is, it's gone in the wrong direction. It's gone from the pockets of working people to the top 0.1%. Anybody here think it's appropriate that the top 0.1% now owns almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%? Anyone think it's appropriate that when families are working such long hours, 58% of all new income is going to the top 1%?
Do you think that politicians should inject more humor into their speeches when they talk about these things?
Yes, as the earlier caller indicated, and as my friends indicate, we say we really need more humor at this point. The billionaires would be more welcome than other activists that take such an approach. But these statistics that Bernie Sanders has just repeated, and of course there are others, you know, the top 0.1% have net worth that's equivalent to that of the entire bottom 90% of the U.S. population. The wealthiest 400 people in this country have wealth that's equivalent to the bottom 61%. And you know, people walk away with very different conclusions from those kinds of statistics.
Well, we have a caller who wants to address them. Harry from Freeport, New York. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Leonard. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a 56-year-old a person who has followed politics and media for 30 years, and I'm frustrated by the media institutions and their representatives that purport to represent a liberal point of view, but, you know, who, when presented with a sincere, earnest politician in Bernie Sanders who expressed his core philosophical liberal ideas about justice, fairness, wealth inequality, the role of government to help people's lives, political corruption, that people like myself have been yearning to hear and see expressed for decades in the media, that those same liberal organizations like the New York Times and MSNBC, they don't support that individual. They don't support Sanders, who so clearly is expressing his love for all of people, for the majority of the people, and not just for the few,
Harry,
the powerful.
Judging from what I've been reading in the newspapers, you're too old to be supporting Bernie Sanders.
I know. That I don't buy that at all. You know, if you come from that liberal point of view, I don't think that changes as you get older. Despite what Churchill might have said years ago, and it just seems to me that there are a lot of people out there like myself that feel this way, but that when we look to our media institutions and I bang my fist on the table because I'm so frustrated by them. This is the person. I mean, he's not, you know, ideally, but this is the person that we've been waiting for to hear and to express it. And he's such a strong talker and so clear and concise, and yet he doesn't get supported by the liberal establishment, in my opinion.
Thanks so much for your comment. I think those are really interesting points. Bernie Sanders, of course, his positions, if you actually poll them, are very widely supported by the public, so that, you know, two-thirds of the people support increasing taxes on those earning more than $1 million. About the same percentage are favor increasing government spending for tuition for public universities. Three-quarters support increasing the minimum wage, so that if you actually poll his issues, he's really not at all out of the mainstream.
So why do you think that he doesn't have the kind of support that would suggest?
Of course, he has wide popular support, but I think your listener is pointing to a very different kind of media coverage of Trump versus Bernie Sanders, and there are lots of complicated reasons for that. But by the way, so just a note on humor in this campaign. You know, we've been sort of all saddened and so on by what's happened recently. But earlier on, there still was a sort of a playfulness and a lightness. Where, if you recall, there was a set of Trump Your Cat videos, and then now we have college students wearing Bernie wigs. So there's still a sort of playfulness that's present.
Robert in Edgewater wants to know if we're seeing fewer conservative groups engaging in satirical protests.
Absolutely, and that's been so striking.
There are conservative satirists,
mm-hmm.
P.J. O'Rourke, for example.
Yes, and during the past decade, we saw some conservative groups springing up, and they just didn't seem to take hold. The liberal groups, the liberal humor, again, tended to have sort of a lighter touch, a more conciliatory approach, and the conservative humor, they think, felt a little heavy-handed, and, you know, perhaps it's an unfair generalization, but the reality is there has not been a lot of it, and it hasn't commanded wide attention.
Let's take another call. Simon from Fairlawn, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Angelique, I'm actually a former student of yours in a wealth and culture class in, like, 2013. My question is about impact and how all these sort of minor protests have an impact, and whether you can really see change and measure change with them or not.
Great. Thanks for your question. Political scientists like to sort of connect the dots and demonstrate legislative impact and other sorts of discrete measurable outcomes from some forms of activism. And that's not really what this is about. It's the sort of last chapter of my book deals with a really wide range of subtle, difficult to trace effects, but very consequential ones. And part of it is building resources for future mobilizations, training people in skills, organizational skills, forms of activism, tools they can use later. And so there's a range of complex impacts that I see that I don't have the time to discuss, but they are in the last chapter of the book, and it's a very important question. Thank you.
And let's go to Rachel. Hi, Rachel. You're on the air from New Brunswick, New Jersey.
Hi. I'm really interested in, I think this is a really great topic, but one concern that I have is being an activist myself, and I go to Rutgers, I'm an undergraduate, I'm more of that traditional protester, I guess, and I've led a lot of environmental activism work, and I've had the opportunity to actually communicate with the people making the decision. So my question is, I can't really imagine wearing a costume and sort of being able to engage with decision makers. So my question is, do these satirical protesters, are they actually on the front lines making the,
You're asking what kind of impact do they really have?
Yeah, not that, but are they more of a support structure?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question, and I think the short answer is yes. They're complementary to the kinds of really important, consequential, serious activism you're doing. And by the way, some of the billionaires step out of costume and are also doing legislative activism and a variety of serious forms of activism as well. Not everyone can put on a costume. It's just one set of semiotics in a toolkit, a wide toolkit of activist tactics.
A number of listeners have written in to say that they're frustrated about the lack of choices for president and the fact that they feel powerless.
Mm-hmm. And that really goes to the heart of the frustration of this political moment, I think. The Saturday Night Live sketch, for example, recently suggested that who has won this moment? Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, among others, because the diagnosis is that we are up against a dysfunctional Congress, a political system that is weighed down by money, where most people in Congress are beholden to moneyed interests, whether they wish to be or not, and the kinds of reforms Elizabeth Warren has proposed, which have really resonated. She's an extremely popular figure in articulating the set of concerns I think you're pointing to.
Well, a number of the critics of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren say they're very idealistic, but unrealistic. They're not really going to get the things they want done.
Yeah, and the answer to that is think about history. So many times in our history, we have attempted what appeared to be impossible. Let's look at the civil rights movement, the women's movement, and labor struggles, which brought us the 40-hour work week and weekends and minimum wages. One has to struggle for real change. And if we don't imagine that change is possible, it certainly isn't going to happen.
We've got
to
sneak one more caller in here. Sam from Rutgers. Hi, you're on the air. Hi, Sam.
Thanks for taking my call. Good afternoon to you both.
Go ahead. You have to make it quick because we're pretty much out of time.
Okay. Angelique, I actually am a disciple of John Leggett, who you may know from Rutgers, who said that the humor injected in any type of political situation is so crucial. So thank you for writing this book and for publicizing it. My question as a second-time caller and third-time listener is, how can Bernie respond to Trump's violent rhetoric by encouraging peace? And how can he use humor in particular to do this?
Mm-hmm. So the most effective approach now is obviously going to be gracefulness, graciousness, and so on. Let's think of a satirical answer. Remember truthiness, Stephen Colbert's truthiness, ersatz truth, which became a zeitgeisty word, as Ben Zimmer said. Satirical billionaires the other night were talking about an equivalent to truthiness, which you might call Trumpiness. Now, Trumpiness is already out there as a meme, but not with that meaning. And so we could all sort of play with humorous possibilities that might help on both sides to sort of lighten what's become a very, very kind of heavy rhetoric.
Angelique Haugerud, her book, No Billionaire Left Behind, the first in our Primary Emotions series. It is published by Stanford University Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
I went down to the Chelsea drugstore to get your prescription filled. I was standing in line with Mr. Jimmy. A man, did he look pretty ill? We decided that we would have a soda. My favorite flavor.
On our next segment in our Primary Emotion series, which is next Tuesday, we'll turn our attention to fear. Our guest will be Daily Show correspondent Hasan Minhaj, and you can join in the conversation anytime by visiting wnyc.org/primaryemotions.